You got it going? Okay. Yeah. All right. I'm not sure if we'll be able to finish the current what we're currently on, and as we're in worldview class. And let me just remind you. Well, I've got next Sunday, and then I'll be out for a while. So. Hopefully we can get to a good stopping place. But to remind you where we are in this, we've been talking about paradigms for worldview, okay? And we talked about three basic paradigms. I'm not going to ask you. I'm going to go ahead and say it for lack of time. We talked about a worldview as a set of categories. You remember that? Categories for interpreting reality, a conceptual framework. Then another model or another paradigm for worldview, we talked about worldview as a set of presuppositions or assumptions. So that's more in the form of propositions. Okay, so there is a God. God is the creator. We should view all things as created, these types of propositions. And we said that both of those paradigms are philosophical, but when we think about presuppositions, it helps to think about the major branches of philosophy. By the way, the third paradigm that we haven't talked about yet, but that we will, and we may talk pretty extensively about this, is worldview as a story. Okay, so that was the third paradigm. We're still in exploring the second paradigm for worldview, and we said that when we talk about the second, it's helpful to think about the major headings under philosophy traditionally. So we said there are ontological presuppositions. Those have to do with the essence of things. With being, okay, what things exist and what's their nature, okay, reality is not only material but spiritual. There's spiritual and physical or reality. There's empirical reality and there's non-empirical reality. These are presuppositions that say a naturalist would deny, but those are ontological presuppositions and part of a Christian worldview. There are epistemological presuppositions. Epistemology, remember, has to do with what we can know and how we know it. Okay, so one of the presuppositions that I would say is really important is that any knowledge that we have. For various reasons, and this kind of relates to the story paradigm, because it relates to how we're created, but also relates to the fact that we're fallen, any knowledge that we have is dependent upon revelation. It's dependent upon God's revealing truth, revealing the way things are to us. That's a fundamental assumption of Christian philosophy and Christian epistemology. So that, for instance, a secular humanist rationalist would assume that we can understand the world simply by investigating and rational analysis, rational contemplation, and that our minds are sufficient to understand the true nature of things. A Christian would say that's not really true. We have true minds, but we have real minds that think and have wonderful capacities, but they are led astray in various ways for various reasons, and they're not sufficient apart from God's revelation to come to the fundamental understanding of fundamental nature of things. That's a basic Christian epistemological presupposition. Okay. Now, we also have the presuppositions in terms of the third branch of philosophy, and that is axiology, And axiology has to do with value, questions of value. Okay, and the two major branches of axiology are aesthetics, which is talking about beauty, criterion for beauty and questions like that, and ethics, right and wrong, okay, morality. And we've been talking about, all right, so we've been under this subset of Christian presuppositions related to morality, because what we've been doing is we've been looking at our guide for morality, God's revelation to us of morality, which is necessary for us to understand right and wrong. Remember the epistemological presupposition. It's necessary. We can't just innately determine, even though God's given us a conscience, our conscience can be seared, our conscience can be suppressed, and our conscience is distorted by our sin. We need God's revelation, and God has revealed what's moral, what's right, in terms of His law. And His law, there are various summaries of His law in Scripture. The most succinct summary, or one of the most succinct, I don't know that it's the most succinct necessarily, is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Now that summarizes the relationship of man to man, but not necessarily man to God. The summary to which Jesus pointed was the two great commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. So God's law is summarized in terms of love. But traditionally, especially in Reformed theology, and particularly in Reformed creeds, God's law has been summarized in terms of the Ten Commandments. And Reformed creeds and Lutheran catechism as well tends to spend a lot of time expositing the Ten Commandments and their meaning. And so we've been talking about the Ten Commandments as sort of a guide to worldview, to priority. What are God's priorities in terms of how we view life, how we view our life in this world, and what our priorities should be as they mirror His priorities? And so we have tried to look at each of the Ten Commandments in terms of summary, and look at the Ten Commandments in general and their structure, and learn some things from them. And so I'm not going to review, because if I do, I'm going to go back through everything, and I already have done that too much in kind of getting us back into focus on where we are in the course. But you remember that we have said that the Ten Commandments are divided, and sometimes this is talked about as the two tables of the law, and that makes people think of the two tablets, but that's not really an accurate understanding of where this comes from, because the two tablets were duplicate copies written on front and back that Moses brought down off the mountain. So it's not like one talks about man's relationship to God, and the other talks about man's relationship to man. That's not an accurate description of what Moses was carrying. However, we do, and most theologians have made a distinction between the first four and the last six in terms of their focus. It's important, as we say that, to remember, and this is something I'm reminding you, that they all have to do with God. And we're going to see that in the way that the Ten Commandments are bookended. And I don't know if we'll get to that today. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. But in terms of these commands, they kind of make that point, among others. But let's just start with five. We said that number five, and here's what I want to do. I was thinking about this week. We haven't done this. We summarized each one in terms of a one-word or couple-of-word major concern that sort of sums up the spirit of the command. What I want to do, though, with respect to the last six is I want to use a couple of words, I think, for each one. And the reason I want to do that is there's you can sum it up in terms of the concern with respect to man and our relationships to other human beings. But then I think we can more generally, as recognizing that all of these commands have to do with God, the major concern as related to our relationship to God as well. So, and we hadn't done that in these few. So that's what I want to go back to five, and just briefly kind of point that out. There she is. Yeah. She knows who Mama is. Okay. So, we said that five, honor your father and mother, has to do, and let me remind you again, as we're talking about each one of these, the way Westminster deals with the Ten Commandments is with each one, there's some additional questions with respect to some of them, but all of the questions, each commandment has at least two. What's required by the commandment and what is forbidden in the commandment, flowing out of the Westminster's, the Shorter Catechism's definition of sin. Sin is when we don't do what the law requires and when we do what the law forbids. So each one, in summarizing the spirit of the command, we need to think not only in terms of what it forbids our doing, which is naturally what most of the commandments lead us to, because most of them are expressed in terms of thou shalt not, in terms of the negative. But they imply a positive as well. And so when we talk about five, honor your father and mother, the key concept is authority. Authority. Okay? Authority in various spheres. And it not only it speaks of and implies ethics with respect to how those who are under authority relate to those who are over them, but also to those who are in authority, how they relate to those under their authority. Both types of obligations are implied. Now, that's with respect to our relationship to human beings who are in authority, but that points to, again, a relationship to God, because the biblical principle is that all authority, all human authority, is delegated. Legitimate human authority comes from God ultimately. So that when we rebel against legitimate human authority, we are in fact rebelling against God's authority. And so the concept that's behind our relationship to people, to other human beings, is the concept of God's sovereignty. God is the Lord. God is the Lord. And we should think of human authority in terms of the covenant concept of mediation. God mediates His sovereignty through various human authorities. And this is the theological focus that we have to have when we're thinking about authority. When we think about, for instance, concepts like, we hear a lot about this mentioned today in political discussions, the importance of the rule of law. Why is the rule of law so important? Because the rule of law points to our submission to God's sovereignty rather than our own autonomy. If we are not ruled by proper law, then what we're saying is I should be a law unto myself, which is autonomy, which is the part of the essence of sin. Sin is what? John tells us, lawlessness. Okay? So, that's five. Six, we said, what's that? Thou shalt not murder. Okay? And so we said that the chief concern there, and we're talking about, okay, again, step back from this. We're talking about what are the major issues of our existence. That's what we're talking about in terms of Ten Commandments. If we have these things straight, then society, this is what civil society is based on. And society is, I can't get secure out of my mind, not secure, but in one sense you could say yes, but it's stable. And so here we're talking about the concern for life. This is why the abortion issue is so important. But not just abortion, issues like euthanasia, issues of capital punishment. All of these things come down to how do we rightly think of, as a people, our concern for life. And just before we go on, let me just again point out, and we talked about this, that when somebody says I'm consistently pro-life, and they say therefore yes, I'm against abortion, but I'm also against capital punishment because I'm consistently pro-life. Again, this is why we need God's law to guide us, because there are a lot of people who are persuaded by that argument, and it's not a valid argument. And the reason is that God says, God is the one who institutes capital punishment. Now, does God institute capital punishment because he doesn't value life as much as some people who say we shouldn't have capital punishment do value life? No. Ironically, as so many things are in God's revelation, it's counterintuitive to shallow thinking. Okay? And shallow thinking says that we never take life if we're concerned for life. No, what it means is that we don't take life except on God's terms. And again, 5 comes before 6 for good reason, because God mediates His authority. God has the right to take life in judgment. And really, strictly speaking, only God does. And so, if God ordains that life be taken as punishment, as equitable punishment for a crime, and in the Noahic Covenant, he tells us what is absolutely deserves capital punishment, and that is murder. Murder deserves capital punishment, because what is an equitable punishment for my taking someone else's life other than my life being forfeit? There is no other equitable punishment. And so it's God who institutes it, but not only that, when He institutes it, He says why He's instituting it. And He institutes, He delegates this to civil authorities, not just to anyone. Not to vigilantes. We don't have this right personally. It is civil government, when He ordains civil government, that has this right. And obedient civil government that conforms to righteousness, to God's law, will practice capital punishment, because when God institutes it, He says, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man." And so it is the worth of that human life that is taken that demands a penalty of severity that recognizes the worth of that life. The only penalty that does that is the penalty of capital punishment. If we don't execute murderers, we are devaluing the life of the one who was murdered. Now, shallow thinking isn't going to consider that. But we do hear people saying, you know, when we hear today all the concern about how murderers are executed, making sure they're comfortable when they're being executed and things like that. And I have to say, you may call me cruel. I'm not that concerned about that. is really, I think I said this last time, if true justice were instituted, we would, I think it would be too complicated to do this. And even the Old Testament, they don't do this. But, you know, if you had strict justice in the methodology, we would employ the same method by which the person was murdered to take the life of the murderer. That's usually impracticable, at least, and sometimes impossible, so we don't do that. But I'm not that concerned about that. But in discussions where people bring up these concerns, you know, we don't want to be cruel. Well, no, we don't want to be cruel. That's true, in the way we execute justice. But you hear people say, but what about the victim? Nobody's thinking about the victim. Well, when we hear people talking like that, they are thinking like God thinks when he institutes capital punishment. So it is a concern for life. Now, again, and I knew I was going to do this, repeat things that we've said, but, you know, in summarizing this again, can't go on unless we say that there's a positive here. Okay, what's the positive? It's that we take measures to preserve life. So this is where, you know, it's not just that I don't do things that unnecessarily endanger other people's lives or that I don't willfully take another life except on God's terms. But also things like, and as much as I hate to admit it, things like seat belts. You know, this is one of those areas where libertarianism is not biblical, and why I'm not a libertarian. I have libertarian tendencies. There's a lot that libertarians say that I think is right, particularly where government intrudes where it shouldn't. But if you look at the law of Moses, it says don't build parapets around the roofs of your houses. Why were they required to do that? Because they spent a lot of time on the roof, and people fell off the roof and died, unless there was something that promoted their safety, and they're not doing that. This is equivalent to our building codes. Now, you know, having built two houses, I get frustrated as anyone with the inspectors sometimes a ridiculous imposition of things that aren't necessary to preserve safety in life, just to sort of exert authority. I think Barney Fife has been reincarnated in building code inspectors. But that having been said, some people would even go so far as to argue, hey, you know, freedom means you're on your own, and I can build any kind of house I want, you know, regardless of how safe it is. No, civil government, according to God's law, has a legitimate interest in preserving life and in passing laws that help to preserve life. And so things like seat belts, you know, things like speed limits, you know, as much as I hate to say it, they fall in this category. They're legitimate for this reason. And they're part of the positive requirements of this command. So as we think about God, then, and this is what we haven't done yet, how is this ultimately rooted in God? What's the concern in terms of life that points to God? If we want to orient that specifically to this, we'd say God as the life giver. So the way that we think about promoting life and the rationale for promoting life looks back to God as the source of life. And where this becomes particularly relevant is when people start talking, when we talk about suicide, or when we talk about assisted suicide, which has become a big thing today. And you'll hear people say, well, you know, I'm going to go out on my own terms, and after all, it's my life. And this is where we say, no, from a Christian perspective, ultimately, it's not your life. Because you didn't decide to be born and you didn't give yourself your life. God gave you your life. And so your life, God has charge over your life, not you. If you're in touch with reality. Now, again, we don't expect people who are in rebellion against God to accept that argument. But it's true, nevertheless. And in terms of public policy and the posture of civil government toward someone who wants to take his own life or her own life, we are obligated to work for laws that prohibit that. Because it's not your life. And I wish more Christians had more of a well-formed worldview, Christian worldview, and would begin to say that when people say, because they're silent. We're silent when people say, after all, it's my life. We don't know what to say. Well, that's what you say. You say, no, it's not your life. There is a Creator who gave you your life. And for you to say, I'm going to go out on my own terms, is a quintessential expression of autonomy. This is autonomy writ large. We recognize it. We can see it very clearly when it's, I'm going to take your life. But it's just as true when someone says, I'm going to take my own life. No, you don't have the right to do that. So again, and why? Because we have a continuing responsibility to acknowledge that God is the giver of life. And it's also the reason why I'm not worried about this, because I don't think it'll ever happen. But why these discussions of these things are relevant, the continuing quest of science to create life in the laboratory, I don't have any worry that that's ever going to happen. At best, all we can do is we can manipulate it. But human beings will never create life. I say that with all confidence. So God is the life giver, and God always will be the sole life giver. Okay, so that brings us to 7. What's 7? Somebody quote Commandment 7? Thou shalt not commit adultery. All right. Again, there's a focus in this command that points to a broader concern. What's the broader concern in adultery? And we might begin by just pointing out what are some of the things involved in this. Okay. Put some flesh on those bones for us. Sylvia, commitment, faith. Okay, how?
Well, the vow was made to God.
Okay. So, which vow? You're talking about marriage, right? Okay. So, again, don't assume anything. So, adultery. What's the definition of adultery? It's sex outside of marriage is adultery. And strictly speaking, when we talk about adultery, we're talking about not just sex outside of marriage, like between two unmarried persons, but someone who is married having sex with someone who is not his or her marriage partner, his or her spouse. That's technically what we say is adultery. Now, we would say, and again, how the Bible fleshes this out in terms of other commands means that it involves prohibiting any sex outside of marriage, so two unmarried persons, because marriage is the context in which God gives sex. And in terms of which we understand our sexuality, which involves more than just the sex act, right? It involves the fact that we're male and female, that we're created male and female, and that in marriage there are marriage roles, and that male and female are not the same, that they're different, and that they're different with respect to each other, their relationship to each other. So, all right, now we're getting into this. So, so what's the concern? What's the ultimate concern then? Now we could talk about this a lot, but again, we're not trying to expound comprehensively the Ten Commandments in this, because that would be a lot longer study. But again, I'll refer you to the larger catechism. I say the shorter catechism too, but the larger catechism is very extensive in its exposition of these commandments. It's larger than the shorter catechism, as you might expect. What's the major concern? How do we sum it up? Yes. I mean, that's certainly, yeah. Okay. That's certainly, I'm trying to figure out how to say this. That's certainly it, with respect to our relationship to God. That's the overall thing. And certainly it's there involved in terms of relationship to man. But specifically in relationship to man and in relationship to society, you know, you may be onto something there, Jody. I'm not sure that even Westminster really appreciates the largeness of that spirit and including other covenants. And, we may need to rethink what the larger spirit is in light of that. What I've said is, and what I had in my mind was that I'm thinking in terms of society, but that covenant keeping in society, you know, boy, that's that may be it, yeah. So, isn't what part of it?
Marriage.
Well, yeah, and that's what I mean. Thinking societally, that's what I had in my mind: marriage, the institution of marriage. And the reason I'm thinking about this is because I'm thinking in terms of creation and things that are established at creation. And in Genesis 2, you have the one flesh union of male and female, and again. The advantage that this has is that it includes sexuality, and all covenant keeping doesn't. And so, specifically, yeah, this is why I tended toward thinking about marriage as the major concern, you know, in terms of society and man's relationship to man, and respect for the institution of marriage. And you could say, actually, not just marriage, but family. The family. As God has ordered it. The importance of the family. Maybe we could say that family is... or that covenant is And covenant keeping is fundamental, really, in some way, to all of these. You know, it's fundamental to everything, you know, because it's that fundamental concept of how God relates, and so how we tend to relate and how we should relate. But yeah, that's really good. And I would say, see, where I was going to put that was, as we think about God, how we relate to God, again, it points us to covenant. And this is why this becomes a paradigm. Marriage becomes a paradigm of our relationship, the relationship of the church to God, Christ and His bride. And how when Paul is talking about the relationship of husband and wife in Ephesians 5, he says, this is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. So he's saying that there's a fundamental reality to which, when God ordains marriage, He's pointing, which has to do with the relationship between God and His people, which is a covenantal relationship, which involves all of these other things, which involves authority and mediation and you know, all the things that are associated with covenant. Okay. Yeah.
Well, if you look at the other two commands, as you have, if you're using unity scriptures as authority structured for man by God, sovereignty, God's nature, life giver, you know, man, and God's will. And in terms of this covenant idea or the prohibition against adultery, it seems to me like family and sexual is part of this. You know, I mean, that's what God has. That's how we honor God, is by implementing the family ordained by God for His purposes and for our welfare. The covenant part of it, for me, might be our concern for the people, for the other people that are affected by adultery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me like it links both to how we're relating to God in terms of our own sexual familial impurities and our concern for others.
Yeah.
In the covenant sense.
Yeah.
Because when you commit adultery, you know, you're not only sinning against your own body, but you're sinning against your neighbor.
Yeah.
You're sinning against the person you're involved in the adultery with.
Yeah.
That seems to me to be covenant oriented.
Yeah. The only thing, and I don't think you're saying this, but just I would say, we don't want to divorce the sexuality thing from our relationship to God. And the reason I say that is because, you know, we said bride, Christ and His bride. But there's a really profound thing here about that the marriage relationship and even sex, the one flesh union, okay, that it is, it points us to the bond that our covenant with God is. That it's meant to be a profound bond of unity, and ultimately, in that we again participate in we are invited into and we are incorporated into the shared life of the Trinity. And how does that happen? And it's an intimacy, it's a bond, it's a oneness. That's God's will for us with Him and with each other, and it's achieved through union with Christ. And union with Christ, the way for union with Christ is paved in the incarnation, in the union of divine and human in one person. so that that makes possible our union with Christ, which makes possible this profound union with God in terms of our very being. And so, you know, the two becoming one flesh is a picture. It points to that fundamental communion and union with God, to that shared life, to that, to quote Doug Kelly, that perichoresis. Love the way he said that. That communion and union. And so, you know, again, these things are pointing to fundamental realities in terms of who God is and how we relate to Him. And in terms of who God is, it points to Trinity. Because this is what God is. This is who God is. God is a multiplicity of persons. He is a society who are in fact one. This is why Trinity is not some abstruse Christian doctrine that we sort of refer to every now and then that's strange and we're kind of embarrassed about it because we can't understand it's incomprehensible. It's absolutely fundamental to everything else. And it's really just in recent theology that there has come to be a renewal of the amount and the type of discussion that really should be happening about the Trinity and Trinitarian theology. It's been neglected for a long time, and it's reflected in the table of contents of systematic theologies, because they talk about doctrine of God and Trinity is kind of almost like a footnote in a lot of them. Instead of the organizing principle, as it should be, really. I just want to make sure that we understand the sex part isn't just about humans as if sex doesn't have anything to do with God. It does. I mean, it points to Him. It points to our relationship to God. It points to who God is, and it points to how we relate to Him and what He wants to do with us and everything. Okay. So, let's go on to, in one sense, the last, and we just have a few minutes, and so I can see what we're going to do next week. What we're going to do is we're going to talk about, we got eight first. Okay. So, what's eight? Thou shalt not steal. Okay. So, what's the concern there? Do what?
It ain't yours, put it back.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's that? How do we summarize that?
Coveting someone else's thing is actually going beyond just the mental part of coveting to acquiring it or appropriating it.
Okay. So when we talk about somebody else's things, what are we talking about? What's the one word? What are we talking about? Yeah, ownership. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, everything belongs to God. If you reach in somebody else's shell and steal and take God, you're stealing from God.
Okay. Now you're getting into the ultimate thing. That's where we're going. So you're racing ahead there, Duncan. You're ahead of everybody else as usual. Yeah, exactly. Let's step back. We're going there full bore in just a second. Ownership of what?
Property.
Okay, so we're talking about property. And again, when we talk about our laws in the United States and Western history, life, liberty, property, That's kind of biblical. That's where it comes from. And property, there is such a thing as private property. So I think this rules out things like the government owning all the property and distributing it to people as it sees fit. That's not the proper role of government. Government doesn't have that right. But what's behind that let's get at it this way. There's a negative, so I shouldn't do things that damage or steal or take. When you steal something, what are you doing? Let's think about that. What are you doing? What are you doing with? Yeah.
Seems like it's twofold.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you're depriving your neighbor of their property.
Yeah.
But you are also acquiring property for yourself through illegitimate means.
Okay. And what does it mean to acquire property? Does it mean I put it in my hope chest, or what are we actually doing? What is the acquisition of property? What are we actually doing?
Transferring ownership.
Okay, ownership, but what is ownership? It's taking control of it, isn't it?
Yes.
It's taking control of the use of it, the appropriation of it, right? So when I steal it, you know, the other person still, you know, if we think of ownership as something that's kind of abstract and legal, ownership hasn't been transferred in that sense. But when I steal, what I'm doing is I'm taking control of how that as a resource is used, is utilized, is developed, is I'm taking control of those things. So, what's the, again, and Westminster's great on this, I think. What's the positive requirement of the Eighth Commandment? I'm not supposed to do that. Something, you know, property is under the control, and I'm deliberately refraining from using a word because I'm going to use it when we get to relationship to God. If that's what it is, it's control over this property, and that is somehow I have the right to the control. What's the positive demand? I'm not supposed to take control away from someone else who legitimately has it of these things,
justice.
Of these resources. What?
Justice.
Okay, what do you mean?
I mean that we're not just prohibited from stealing.
Yeah.
That is, I shouldn't take something by fraud or default. I shouldn't stand by when other people are being.
Okay. Now, and since that could be so easily misunderstood, we need to hasten to add not egalitarianism, but justice. Because justice doesn't mean that everyone should have the same amount of goods or resources necessarily. Because God gives to some 10 cities, some 5 cities, you know, he gives to some more talents than others. But it is that there are things that can compromise what a person should own in terms of God's law. We could go into that in a lot of detail, but I see two hands. Yeah, Tony.
So wouldn't it positively also involve, with respect to ourselves, making right use of what we have?
Absolutely.
Toward our neighbor, protecting their control of God's.
Absolutely. And,
Something like productivity or stewardship.
Yeah, yeah. That's where we're going. Because what does God demand? When He commands us to be, again, we go back to creation. What does God command us? What does He give mankind in general stewardship of? Ownership of? Management of? It's, because, again, He's the ultimate owner. He's the only real owner. What we are is managers. We're stewards. And He says, and when he gives us, He gives us the earth. And He says, develop its potential. Now, I've given you examples of how you do that. It was chaos, and I brought order to it. Now I want you to do the same thing in imaging Me. And what is that? It's being what? Be fruitful. Be fruitful. Be productive. Produce useful things out of this that over which I'm giving you management. Bring out the potential that's latent in it. That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to be productive in terms of work. And so the Westminster Confession says that the positive, the thou shalt of the eighth command is that we have an obligation to further, just like Tony and Tyler were saying, to further our own and our neighbor's wealth and outward estate. We have an obligation to do that. That may be counterintuitive to the way some people think of spirituality. But I think it's absolutely right. And it goes right back to the cultural mandate. So, with respect to God then, what's the ultimate concern? What's the ultimate concern? It's stewardship. Okay? You see, I have the responsibility with respect to other people to live in such a way that it enhances their ability to prosper in terms of their prosperity, to increase their wealth and outward estate. But why? It's ultimately unto God, because what God wants us to do is use what He's given us to promote His glory, and He's given us different things, and He's given us different endowments so that we have the capacity to work with different kinds of things and different kinds of property. And there are all kinds of things that tie into this. But again, it all comes back to stewardship and management of resources that God has committed to us as human beings. And the way that we manage those things is to reflect Him and His own bringing order out of chaos. And it is to bring glory to Him. And so all of the rules that have to do with this promote that and keep us within certain parameters based on this ultimate concern of that this really has to do with our relationship to God. And that it's God who requires this of us. Okay? Does that make sense? So, this has all kinds of vast worldview implications. How do we look at property? How do we look at our relationship to the world? How do we look at our relationship to creation? There is a biblical environmentalism. There is. We should be environmentalists as Christians. We should be. We should be appalled at unrestricted strip mining that just destroys, that just absolutely rapes the resources and the usefulness of that part of the earth. You know, and there are all kinds of other examples. So, you know, that's part of a Christian worldview. And it's one reason why you can't equate Christianity with the Democrat Party or the Republican Party or libertarianism or any philosophy. It is its own category, and it receives its content from God's revelation only. Okay, we got to stop there because we're out of time. So we'll try to wrap up Ten Commandments next week, okay?